Cambridge International Examinations, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, June Examination Session, 2014. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier, Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready. Here is the test. Look at questions 1 to 6. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answers should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Which television program did the students decide to watch?
There's a really good program at 8 o'clock tonight about sharks. I really want to watch it.
Sharks? But I'm not doing a marine biology course. I'm studying geography. I'd rather watch the programme about volcanoes. It's on at the same time.
OK, let's watch your programme this time and mine next week. There's a really good programme at 8 o'clock tonight about sharks. I really want to watch it.
Sharks? But I'm not doing a marine biology course. I'm studying geography. I'd rather watch the programme about volcanoes. It's on at the same time.
OK, let's watch your programme this time and mine next week.
Question 2. How did Sana find out that the train service will close down?
Did you hear that announcement today on the local transport news, Sana?
No, but if it was about the train service, I think it's awful news. My father told me all about it. I've been using that service for years, and it's been fine. To think that they're stopping it simply because it costs too much money. What will I do now?
It sounds as if you'll be buying a car. Did you hear that announcement today on the local transport news, Sana?
No, but if it was about the train service, I think it's awful news. My father told me all about it. I've been using that service for years, and it's been fine. To think that they're stopping it simply because it costs too much money. What will I do now?
It sounds as if you'll be buying a car.
Question 3. When and where will the students go to find out who their main teacher is?
Where did they ask us to meet this afternoon?
In room 4 at 3 p.m. Then we'll meet our head of year, who will help us with any problems we might have, but won't actually be teaching us.
Oh, I see. So, what are we doing tomorrow then?
Tomorrow morning, we'll meet our course teacher in the computer room. Room 14 is our main teaching room, which is right next door.
Where did they ask us to meet this afternoon?
In room 4 at 3 p.m. Then we'll meet our head of year, who will help us with any problems we might have, but won't actually be teaching us.
Oh, I see. So, what are we doing tomorrow then?
Tomorrow morning, we'll meet our course teacher in the computer room. Room 14 is our main teaching room, which is right next door.
Question 4. Why is the neighbour pleased that the parcel has been delivered? Give two details.
Hello, I'm your new neighbour. I think you might have a parcel for me.
Yes, I do. The postman brought it yesterday, but you were out, so I said I'd sign the form to show I'd received it. I hope that's okay.
Yes, that's great. I'm glad you were at home. I've been waiting for that pipe for 3 weeks. I need it to fix my shower. Hello, I'm your new neighbour. I think you might have a parcel for me.
Yes, I do. The postman brought it yesterday, but you were out, so I said I'd sign the form to show I'd received it. I hope that's okay.
Yes, that's great. I'm glad you were at home. I've been waiting for that pipe for 3 weeks. I need it to fix my shower.
Question 5. Why does the woman object to the housing plan?
Good evening, everyone, and thanks for coming to this public meeting. The new housing development will provide houses for ordinary people.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but the plan I've seen shows that only 30% of the houses will cost what most people can afford. The rest are priced much higher than this. So how can you say that the focus is on ordinary people?
We pride ourselves on the number of inexpensive houses we provide. Other companies build far fewer than we do.
That might be so, but 30% is just not enough. That figure should be much higher.
Good evening, everyone, and thanks for coming to this public meeting. The new housing development will provide houses for ordinary people.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but the plan I've seen shows that only 30% of the houses will cost what most people can afford. The rest are priced much higher than this. So how can you say that the focus is on ordinary people?
We pride ourselves on the number of inexpensive houses we provide. Other companies build far fewer than we do.
That might be so, but 30% is just not enough. That figure should be much higher.
Question 6. Which two items does Ahmed bring to impress his interviewer?
Hello, I'm Ahmed Kabir, and I'm here for the job interview.
Okay, hello, Ahmed. Here's your visitor's badge. You'll need that to get past the barrier there. Once you're through, please go to the reception area B. Our artistic director, Mrs. Banks, will meet you there. She is going to interview you.
Right. I've got a copy of my passport, as you requested. Also, I've brought the newspaper article about the prize I won last year.
Oh, good. I see you've brought a sample of your artwork, too.
Hello, I'm Ahmed Kabir, and I'm here for the job interview.
Okay, hello, Ahmed. Here's your visitor's badge. You'll need that to get past the barrier there. Once you're through, please go to the reception area B. Our artistic director, Mrs. Banks, will meet you there. She is going to interview you.
Right. I've got a copy of my passport, as you requested. Also, I've brought the newspaper article about the prize I won last year.
Oh, good. I see you've brought a sample of your artwork, too.
That is the last of questions 1 to 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. Listen to the following interview with the manager of a busy international airport, and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
I'm here today with Anders Helm. Hi, Anders. It's been a while since I was here at Kuala Lumpur International Airport. Hasn't it changed a lot?
Hello. Yes, we're an ultra-modern facility these days. We're regarded by experts as one of the top 5 airports in the world in terms of being up to date.
What would you say is the most important development at the airport in the last few years?
Without any doubt, it's our TAMS, our Total Airport Management System. It enables us to connect all the electronic information systems within the airport to ensure the smooth flow of information between the different sections and areas.
So how exactly does TAMS work?
Because TAMS uses a central database, all of the airport's 17 subsystems are now connected. So this means that there's never any isolated information, and everyone in the airport, from the check-in clerk to the pilot, has access to the data.
That must use a lot of cables.
Yes. We call it a multimedia super corridor, and it needs about 50 kilometres of cabling. We use fibre optic cable, so it's one of the fastest means of sending data.
I hear that you're becoming more popular now as a result of this major technology upgrade.
Indeed. We're now ranked as the 14th busiest airport in the world by Air Traffic magazine.
How many passengers use the airport, Anders?
Currently about 45 million a year. But by 2020, we hope this will be closer to 80 million. We've been expanding since 2010 in a 4-phase plan. We've reached phase 3 now, so we've upgraded the terminals, the passenger facilities and the runways, all with the help of TAMS.
I'm very impressed with the rail links between the different parts of the airport. I used the monorail to get here, and so far I've not had to walk very much at all.
Every part of the complex is linked by driverless trains and by moving walkways. Our aim in including these is that passengers never have to walk more than 100 metres from checking in to boarding the flight, or from getting off an aircraft to collecting their luggage.
It's a big complex, isn't it?
Yes. We have 2 hotels in here. A 4-star with 400 rooms and a 5-star with 84 rooms.
And so many shops too.
210 to be precise. We had only 105 last year, so the number has doubled.
You must be very proud to have been part of all this redevelopment and success. What are your favourite aspects of the complex, Anders?
I think my favourite project has been setting up a small-scale rainforest. It's over there. The enclosed area, with real trees and plants from Malaysia.
It must have some animals, then.
No, that would be a health risk to passengers, so I'm afraid it's plants only in there. We check it daily to ensure that the plants are the only living things.
Anything else?
The boardwalk. This is where we display artwork from this region. You can see some paintings by artists from Thailand there at the moment.
Oh, sorry, Anders. That's my mobile phone.
It's telling you that you need to board your flight to Singapore. Just as I said, our central database knows everything.
Now you will hear the interview again.
I'm here today with Anders Helm. Hi, Anders. It's been a while since I was here at Kuala Lumpur International Airport. Hasn't it changed a lot?
Hello. Yes, we're an ultra-modern facility these days. We're regarded by experts as one of the top 5 airports in the world in terms of being up to date.
What would you say is the most important development at the airport in the last few years?
Without any doubt, it's our TAMS, our Total Airport Management System. It enables us to connect all the electronic information systems within the airport to ensure the smooth flow of information between the different sections and areas.
So how exactly does TAMS work?
Because TAMS uses a central database, all of the airport's 17 subsystems are now connected. So this means that there's never any isolated information, and everyone in the airport, from the check-in clerk to the pilot, has access to the data.
That must use a lot of cables.
Yes. We call it a multimedia super corridor, and it needs about 50 kilometres of cabling. We use fibre optic cable, so it's one of the fastest means of sending data.
I hear that you're becoming more popular now as a result of this major technology upgrade.
Indeed. We're now ranked as the 14th busiest airport in the world by Air Traffic magazine.
How many passengers use the airport, Anders?
Currently about 45 million a year. But by 2020, we hope this will be closer to 80 million. We've been expanding since 2010 in a four-phase plan. We've reached phase three now, so we've upgraded the terminals, the passenger facilities and the runways, all with the help of TAMS.
I'm very impressed with the rail links between the different parts of the airport. I used the monorail to get here, and so far I've not had to walk very much at all.
Every part of the complex is linked by driverless trains and by moving walkways. Our aim in including these is that passengers never have to walk more than 100 metres from checking in to boarding the flight, or from getting off an aircraft to collecting their luggage.
It's a big complex, isn't it?
Yes. We have two hotels in here. A four-star with 400 rooms and a five-star with 84 rooms.
And so many shops too.
210 to be precise. We had only 105 last year, so the number has doubled.
You must be very proud to have been part of all this redevelopment and success. What are your favourite aspects of the complex, Anders?
I think my favourite project has been setting up a small-scale rainforest. It's over there, the enclosed area, with real trees and plants from Malaysia.
It must have some animals, then.
No, that would be a health risk to passengers, so I'm afraid it's plants only in there. We check it daily to ensure that the plants are the only living things.
Anything else?
The boardwalk. This is where we display artwork from this region. You can see some paintings by artists from Thailand there at the moment.
Oh, sorry, Anders. That's my mobile phone.
It's telling you that you need to board your flight to Singapore. Just as I said, our central database knows everything.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Listen to the following radio interview with a man who is talking about his work as a film and television extra, and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hi, Rick. You're going to tell us about your job, a rather unusual job, as a film extra.
Yes. Hi. I've been working as an extra now for 10 years.
Just tell the listeners what an extra does.
OK. But before I do that, I should say that we're sometimes known by other names. A background actor is the most common term used for us. Basically, we appear in films or television, but not as the main roles. We play the minor parts. We may spend 20 seconds or 20 minutes or 2 hours in front of the camera.
Give us an example, Rick.
OK. My last role was in a film called Code Red. While the two main actors were discussing a plan of action in a cafe, I was sitting behind them, enjoying a coffee. I had nothing to say. I was in the film for just 3 minutes and didn't appear anywhere else. I was one of the 6 extras playing coffee drinkers in that scene.
And if you don't mind me asking, how much did you get paid for that work?
We usually get paid a daily rate. At the moment, £350. And that's the fee we got for that particular job.
Sounds as if there's not much in the way of preparation, then. No speeches to be learned.
Not for that role, no. But it's not always as simple as that. I had a minor part last year in a television programme. It was in a long-running series about a hospital. My work lasted for 3 weeks. I played a cleaner and was given some dialogue, talking to a nurse in a corridor.
It must be difficult to get work.
Yes, I use an agent to help me find suitable acting roles.
How does that work, then?
Well, I'm fit and healthy, and especially good at swimming. So my agent finds me parts in films that require swimmers. I'm also a good surfer, so I need to stay fit for these active roles.
How is your agent paid, Rick?
It depends on the work he gets for me. All of my earnings are paid to him. He keeps 15% of whatever I earn. I get the daily rate I already mentioned for a minor non-speaking role. But if I have to speak some lines, then I become what is known as a day performer. The fee then is much higher.
That sounds like a fair deal. So, if I wanted to become an extra, what information would I need to give to the agent?
Your main contact number is the most important thing. Also, the age range you feel you can cover. For me, that's between 30 and 50. And, of course, your height and weight.
Quite a long list.
There's more. Whether you play a musical instrument and any hobbies you have. Also, any unusual features on your body, such as tattoos, scars or injuries.
Do you have any unusual features, Rick?
My hair. As you can see, it's rather long. As a result, I've been in quite a few films playing musicians and rock stars.
What would you say was your most enjoyable role as an extra?
That's easy. I spent 2 weeks in Paris last year. It was a film based around the French Open tournament, and I appeared as a tennis player for about 12 minutes. Being able to meet professional players was great, and I was given a free ticket to the final.
Brilliant. Thanks, Rick. I hope it keeps going well for you.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hi, Rick. You're going to tell us about your job, a rather unusual job, as a film extra.
Yes. Hi. I've been working as an extra now for 10 years.
Just tell the listeners what an extra does.
OK. But before I do that, I should say that we're sometimes known by other names. A background actor is the most common term used for us. Basically, we appear in films or television, but not as the main roles. We play the minor parts. We may spend 20 seconds or 20 minutes or 2 hours in front of the camera.
Give us an example, Rick.
OK. My last role was in a film called Code Red. While the two main actors were discussing a plan of action in a cafe, I was sitting behind them, enjoying a coffee. I had nothing to say. I was in the film for just 3 minutes and didn't appear anywhere else. I was one of the 6 extras playing coffee drinkers in that scene.
And if you don't mind me asking, how much did you get paid for that work?
We usually get paid a daily rate. At the moment, £350. And that's the fee we got for that particular job.
Sounds as if there's not much in the way of preparation, then. No speeches to be learned.
Not for that role, no. But it's not always as simple as that. I had a minor part last year in a television programme. It was in a long-running series about a hospital. My work lasted for 3 weeks. I played a cleaner and was given some dialogue, talking to a nurse in a corridor.
It must be difficult to get work.
Yes, I use an agent to help me find suitable acting roles.
How does that work, then?
Well, I'm fit and healthy, and especially good at swimming. So my agent finds me parts in films that require swimmers. I'm also a good surfer, so I need to stay fit for these active roles.
How is your agent paid, Rick?
It depends on the work he gets for me. All of my earnings are paid to him. He keeps 15% of whatever I earn. I get the daily rate I already mentioned for a minor non-speaking role. But if I have to speak some lines, then I become what is known as a day performer. The fee then is much higher.
That sounds like a fair deal. So, if I wanted to become an extra, what information would I need to give to the agent?
Your main contact number is the most important thing. Also, the age range you feel you can cover. For me, that's between 30 and 50. And, of course, your height and weight.
Quite a long list.
There's more. Whether you play a musical instrument and any hobbies you have. Also, any unusual features on your body, such as tattoos, scars or injuries.
Do you have any unusual features, Rick?
My hair. As you can see, it's rather long. As a result, I've been in quite a few films playing musicians and rock stars.
What would you say was your most enjoyable role as an extra?
That's easy. I spent 2 weeks in Paris last year. It was a film based around the French Open tournament, and I appeared as a tennis player for about 12 minutes. Being able to meet professional players was great, and I was given a free ticket to the final.
Brilliant. Thanks, Rick. I hope it keeps going well for you.
That is the end of question 8. In a moment, you will hear question 9. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam.
You'll hear an interview with a man who enjoys flying in a small aircraft called a microlight. For questions 9 to 18, complete the sentences. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 2.
Now, today I have with me Brian Colford, and he's someone who spends a lot of time up in the air in that smallest of aircraft, the microlight. Hello, Brian.
Hello.
But it's more than just a hobby, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I learned to fly when I was at university, and I worked as a British Airways pilot for many years until my retirement. These days I spend a lot of my time helping people who want to learn how to fly a microlight, as well as other types of aircraft, at a local flying club.
Tell us about the microlight.
Well, it's like a very small aircraft which is powered by an engine. The thing with microlight flying is that it's the closest you can get to actually feeling like a bird, because you're out in the open air, there's no cabin or anything around you.
Oh, I see.
And although it's powered, the way it's controlled is by moving your own weight. You steer it by moving your body one way or another.
So you have to lean over like you would on a motorbike?
You don't lean, really. You actually have to push. So you have to be quite fit, especially for a long flight.
Which brings us on to the other thing which I know about you, and that is that you've recently broken a world record. Tell us about that.
Well, it involved flying over four continents, because I left from London and flew over Europe, Africa and Asia on the way to Australia. No one had ever done that before in a microlight.
The organisation for a long flight must be very difficult indeed, Brian. Surely you didn't do it all on your own?
Yes, I had no helpers. It was a matter of planning my route in advance and finding out where I'd be able to get fuel en route and knowing how far I could plan to travel safely each day.
So how far can you travel on one tank of fuel?
Well, I had a special fuel tank fitted. That was the only way in which my microlight was modified for the flight. So that meant I had enough fuel to be able to do about 8 hours. The actual distance I covered, it depended on the winds, of course, but the still air distance was around about 500 miles a day. It took 9 months to plan the 49-day flight, and for each leg I filed a flight plan so that each airport I would land at knew that I was on the way, and if I didn't arrive within half an hour of the time I'd stated, then they'd have started looking for me.
Yes, I'm sure that's very necessary. What radio, if any, did you have?
Yes, I had a two-way VHF radio, but the range of that was only 70 miles. So there was a lot of time when I was out of radio contact with anybody. I crossed thousands of miles of desert and mountain, which is quite dangerous, of course, should anything go wrong. And 5,000 miles of the trip was over the sea, which is even more so.
So how did you find your way?
Well, I had a navigation system which uses satellite signals. It was really easy to use, and I must say, very accurate. I couldn't say I had any problems in knowing where I was or which way I was going.
And what sort of protection did you have? I mean, you weren't just dangling in the cold air, were you?
Yeah, I just wear a warm flying suit and warm clothes underneath. The coldest was going over the Alps. It was minus 28 degrees there because I was quite high up. But actually feeling tired was my real problem, because it was often dark by the time I landed and I was leaving again at first light. I was never hungry because I was met by such great hospitality everywhere I went. Although, sadly, I didn't get to see much of the places I visited.
Well, Brian, many congratulations. It's a wonderful achievement, and thank you very much for coming in today and talking about...
Now you'll hear part two again.
Now, today I have with me Brian Colford, and he's someone who spends a lot of time up in the air in that smallest of aircraft, the microlight. Hello, Brian.
Hello.
But it's more than just a hobby, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I learned to fly when I was at university, and I worked as a British Airways pilot for many years until my retirement. These days I spend a lot of my time helping people who want to learn how to fly a microlight, as well as other types of aircraft, at a local flying club.
Tell us about the microlight.
Well, it's like a very small aircraft which is powered by an engine. The thing with microlight flying is that it's the closest you can get to actually feeling like a bird, because you're out in the open air, there's no cabin or anything around you.
Oh, I see.
And although it's powered, the way it's controlled is by moving your own weight. You steer it by moving your body one way or another.
So you have to lean over like you would on a motorbike?
You don't lean, really. You actually have to push. So you have to be quite fit, especially for a long flight.
Which brings us on to the other thing which I know about you, and that is that you've recently broken a world record. Tell us about that.
Well, it involved flying over four continents, because I left from London and flew over Europe, Africa and Asia on the way to Australia. No one had ever done that before in a microlight.
The organisation for a long flight must be very difficult indeed, Brian. Surely you didn't do it all on your own?
Yes, I had no helpers. It was a matter of planning my route in advance and finding out where I'd be able to get fuel en route and knowing how far I could plan to travel safely each day.
So how far can you travel on one tank of fuel?
Well, I had a special fuel tank fitted. That was the only way in which my microlight was modified for the flight. So that meant I had enough fuel to be able to do about 8 hours. The actual distance I covered, it depended on the winds, of course, but the still air distance was around about 500 miles a day. It took 9 months to plan the 49-day flight, and for each leg I filed a flight plan so that each airport I would land at knew that I was on the way, and if I didn't arrive within half an hour of the time I'd stated, then they'd have started looking for me.
Yes, I'm sure that's very necessary. What radio, if any, did you have?
Yes, I had a two-way VHF radio, but the range of that was only 70 miles. So there was a lot of time when I was out of radio contact with anybody. I crossed thousands of miles of desert and mountain, which is quite dangerous, of course, should anything go wrong. And 5,000 miles of the trip was over the sea, which is even more so.
So how did you find your way?
Well, I had a navigation system which uses satellite signals. It was really easy to use, and I must say, very accurate. I couldn't say I had any problems in knowing where I was or which way I was going.
And what sort of protection did you have? I mean, you weren't just dangling in the cold air, were you?
Yeah, I just wear a warm flying suit and warm clothes underneath. The coldest was going over the Alps. It was minus 28 degrees there, because I was quite high up. But actually feeling tired was my real problem, because it was often dark by the time I landed, and I was leaving again at first light. I was never hungry, because I was met by such great hospitality everywhere I went. Although, sadly, I didn't get to see much of the places I visited.
Well, Brian, many congratulations. It's a wonderful achievement, and thank you very much for coming in today and talking about...
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You'll hear five different people talking about short courses they have attended. For questions 19 to 23, choose from the list A to F what each speaker says about their course. Use the letters only once. There's one extra letter which you do not need to use. You now have 30 seconds in which to look at part three. Speaker 1.
I went on a canoeing course last weekend, rather against my better judgment, because although I enjoy swimming, I thought canoeing might be too difficult. And I was right. I really couldn't get the hang of it. I bet the tutors will remember me, not because I was one of their star students, far from it, but I fell out of the canoe more often than everyone else put together. But even so, I enjoyed it so much that when some of the groups signed up to do another course together in 6 months' time, I found myself signing up too. I bet the tutors refuse to teach me next time.
Speaker 2.
It was really good fun. 15 people from all sorts of backgrounds, all desperately trying to speak Italian to each other. And most of us were absolute beginners. We kept falling about laughing. But actually, it did get a lot easier by the last day, and the tutors were awfully patient. It was held in a big house in the country, which now belongs to a university, and the whole thing was brilliant. In fact, I don't know how they can do it for what they charged, because it was almost like staying in a luxury hotel. Maybe it was subsidised by the university.
Speaker 3.
It was quite an odd sort of course in a way, because I expected everyone to be working together and helping each other to learn. But most of the time we were all just working on our own computers, with the tutor going round and helping each person individually. No teamwork at all. It made me realise that I work much better with other people than on my own. Maybe it's poor motivation or something. Anyway, I learned much more about using a computer, which is what I wanted. So I suppose it was worth it, even though I can't say I enjoyed it much.
Speaker 4.
I can hardly move. I'm so exhausted. We were out on the courts playing tennis from morning to night, practically. I'm certainly not as fit as I ought to be. I suppose they thought we'd want to play all day to get our money's worth. Well, I could have done with a bit more theory and demonstrations, and a lot more taking it easy. They told me I should go on to the advanced course next month, but I don't know. I think they have to say that to get the bookings, because they seem to be saying the same thing to everyone.
Speaker 5.
There were several people I've met on other courses. I haven't been on that many, but some of them seem to take at least a dozen a year. Actually, we ended up spending a lot of time chatting and going for walks in the garden, and that kind of made up for the fact that I didn't really learn much about local history, which is why I'd gone. The tutor certainly knew a lot about the subject, but she seemed to have very little idea how to teach, so I just couldn't get into it. And it cost enough. I probably need to find a better way of studying.
Now you'll hear part 3 again. Speaker 1.
I went on a canoeing course last weekend, rather against my better judgment, because although I enjoy swimming, I thought canoeing might be too difficult. And I was right. I really couldn't get the hang of it. I bet the tutors will remember me, not because I was one of their star students, far from it, but I fell out of the canoe more often than everyone else put together. But even so, I enjoyed it so much that when some of the group signed up to do another course together in 6 months' time, I found myself signing up too. I bet the tutors refuse to teach me next time.
Speaker 2.
It was really good fun. 15 people from all sorts of backgrounds, all desperately trying to speak Italian to each other. And most of us were absolute beginners. We kept falling about laughing. But actually, it did get a lot easier by the last day, and the tutors were awfully patient. It was held in a big house in the country, which now belongs to a university, and the whole thing was brilliant. In fact, I don't know how they can do it for what they charged, because it was almost like staying in a luxury hotel. Maybe it was subsidised by the university.
Speaker 3.
It was quite an odd sort of course in a way, because I expected everyone to be working together and helping each other to learn. But most of the time we were all just working on our own computers, with the tutor going round and helping each person individually. No teamwork at all. It made me realise that I work much better with other people than on my own. Maybe it's poor motivation or something. Anyway, I learned much more about using a computer, which is what I wanted. So I suppose it was worth it, even though I can't say I enjoyed it much.
Speaker 4.
I can hardly move. I'm so exhausted. We were out on the courts playing tennis from morning to night, practically. I'm certainly not as fit as I ought to be. I suppose they thought we'd want to play all day to get our money's worth. Well, I could have done with a bit more theory and demonstrations, and a lot more taking it easy. They told me I should go on to the advanced course next month, but I don't know. I think they have to say that to get the bookings, because they seem to be saying the same thing to everyone.
Speaker 5.
There were several people I've met on other courses. I haven't been on that many, but some of them seem to take at least a dozen a year. Actually, we ended up spending a lot of time chatting and going for walks in the garden, and that kind of made up for the fact that I didn't really learn much about local history, which is why I'd gone. The tutor certainly knew a lot about the subject, but she seemed to have very little idea how to teach, so I just couldn't get into it. And it cost enough. I'd probably need to find a better way of studying.
That's the end of part three. Now turn to part four. You'll hear part of a radio interview with Martin Middleton, who makes wildlife programmes for television. For questions 24 to 30, choose the best answer, A, B or C. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part four.
Today's guest needs no introduction. He is a man who's given us hours of interest and entertainment over the years with his weekly series of wildlife programmes. He is, of course, Martin Middleton. Martin, you've been to the four corners of the earth in search of material. Where did this love of adventures come from?
I don't really know. I didn't travel much as a child, but I remember reading about the East and being fascinated by it. Then, when I was about 12, I met someone who'd been to Singapore. And to me, that seemed incredible. And, of course, when I started in television back in the early 1960s, you didn't travel to make a wildlife programme. You went along and filmed at the local zoo. So when I said I'd like to go and film in Africa, the head of programmes just laughed at me.
And did you go to Africa?
On that occasion, no. But I eventually got them to allow me to go to Borneo in 1962. There was just me and a cameraman. We went off for 4 months, filming wherever we found something interesting. We bought a canoe, sailed up river for 10 days, and ended up in a traditional longhouse. Nowadays, of course, it's all quite different.
Different? In what way?
We do months of preparation before we set off, so when we start filming, we know exactly what scenes we want to get. I mean, you don't get up in the morning and say to your team, "What shall we do this morning?" You have to know exactly what each scene is going to show, to work to a strict plan.
Some of your programmes have taken place in some pretty remote areas. It's hard to imagine other programme makers wanting to risk the dangers or discomfort that you've experienced.
Well, if you want original material, you've got to go off the beaten track. But you can find yourself doing some pretty strange things. Like, for example, on one occasion, jumping out of a helicopter onto an iceberg. There I was, freezing cold. Then it started to snow, and the helicopter had gone back to the ship and couldn't take off again. So I was stuck there on his iceberg thinking, "This is crazy. I didn't even want to come here."
What I wonder is, where does somebody like yourself, who travels to all these exotic places as part of their work, go on holiday?
I'm not very good at lying on a beach, that's for sure. I wouldn't go to a place just to sit around. It's nice to have an objective when you're travelling, to have something you want to film. I've just come back from the Dominican Republic, and we were put up for the first night in a big hotel. The place was absolutely full of people, just lying there sunbathing. They seemed quite happy to spend the whole day stretched out around the pool. They never seemed to want to go and explore the amazing things there were to see outside the hotel. For me, that would be a very boring way to spend a holiday.
Your programmes, though, must have inspired a lot of people to take their holidays in remote and little-known places.
You are probably right. But, well, I have mixed feelings about all this. I go back to the places where, years ago, I was the only European. And now there are cruise ships coming 3 times a day. So you worry that in 10 years or so, every remote place on the planet will be swallowed up, because everyone will be visiting it. But, on the other hand, I am in favour of tourism that is done in a way that protects the environment. You can see a good example of this in the Galapagos Islands, where the tourism is carefully managed. That's very successful and could be a model for the future.
Now you'll hear part 4 again.
Today's guest needs no introduction. He is a man who's given us hours of interest and entertainment over the years with his weekly series of wildlife programmes. He is, of course, Martin Middleton. Martin, you've been to the four corners of the earth in search of material. Where did this love of adventures come from?
I don't really know. I didn't travel much as a child, but I remember reading about the East and being fascinated by it. Then, when I was about 12, I met someone who'd been to Singapore, and to me that seemed incredible. And, of course, when I started in television back in the early 1960s, you didn't travel to make a wildlife programme. You went along and filmed at the local zoo. So, when I said I'd like to go and film in Africa, the head of programmes just laughed at me.
And did you go to Africa?
On that occasion, no. But I eventually got them to allow me to go to Borneo in 1962. There was just me and a cameraman. We went off for 4 months, filming wherever we found something interesting. We bought a canoe, sailed up river for 10 days, and ended up in a traditional longhouse. Nowadays, of course, it's all quite different.
Different in what way?
We do months of preparation before we set off, so when we start filming, we know exactly what scenes we want to get. I mean, you don't get up in the morning and say to your team, "What shall we do this morning?" You have to know exactly what each scene is going to show, to work to a strict plan.
Some of your programmes have taken place in some pretty remote areas. It's hard to imagine other programme makers wanting to risk the dangers or discomfort that you've experienced.
Well, if you want original material, you've got to go off the beaten track. But you can find yourself doing some pretty strange things. Like, for example, on one occasion, jumping out of a helicopter onto an iceberg. There I was, freezing cold. Then it started to snow, and the helicopter had gone back to the ship and couldn't take off again. So I was stuck there on his iceberg thinking, "This is crazy. I didn't even want to come here."
What I wonder is, where does somebody like yourself, who travels to all these exotic places as part of their work, go on holiday?
I'm not very good at lying on a beach, that's for sure. I wouldn't go to a place just to sit around. It's nice to have an objective when you're travelling, to have something you want to film. I've just come back from the Dominican Republic, and we were put up for the first night in a big hotel. The place was absolutely full of people, just lying there sunbathing. They seemed quite happy to spend the whole day stretched out around the pool. They never seemed to want to go and explore the amazing things there were to see outside the hotel. For me, that would be a very boring way to spend a holiday.
Your programmes, though, must have inspired a lot of people to take their holidays in remote and little-known places.
You are probably right. But, well, I have mixed feelings about all this. I go back to the places where, years ago, I was the only European. And now there are cruise ships coming 3 times a day. So you worry that in 10 years or so, every remote place on the planet will be swallowed up, because everyone will be visiting it. But, on the other hand, I am in favour of tourism that is done in a way that protects the environment. You can see a good example of this in the Galapagos Islands, where the tourism is carefully managed. That's very successful and could be a model for the future.
That is the end of part 4. There will now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. I shall remind you when there is 1 minute left so that you are sure to finish in time. That is the end of the test, Please stop now. Your supervisor will now collect all the question papers and answer sheets.